order them off-planet while you've got a good excuse to? I wouldn't mind seeing the last of that Chief Inspector Sneef.
That's not a bad idea, said Fool. I don't think we're in quite that much trouble, though, but I'll keep it in mind in case things get dangerous.
All righty, you're a big boy. But don't ever say I never gave you a chance to get rid of that pest, said Mother.
She cut the connection, and Fool turned to his crew. In moments, the rescue party was loaded on the personnel carrier. At Fool's command, Slayer took the controls, lifted it off, and started moving forward at top speed. Fool stood on the forward bench, looking through his stereoculars in an attempt to see what was going on up ahead. He could hear what sounded like distant shouting, though not in any language he recognized. Had the Cynthian lost his translator, or was there some other species there? He realized he didn't know who else was on the original search team. He'd left it to Brandy to choose its members, and hadn't thought to ask once the crisis had arisen. In a sense, it didn't really matter who was out there. They were all valued members of Omega Company. Their comrades in arms would do whatever it took to bring them back safe. Omega Company took care of its own, and anyone who stood in the way, well, too bad for them, Fool thought. The personnel carrier had quickly covered the ground between the camp and the trees and was coming up on the position where Fool had decided to drop off the Gambolts. Slayer, bring the vehicle to a halt, he ordered. Dukes, Rube, Garbo, make ready to dismount. Slayer expertly cut the vehicle's speed and dropped it to within a hand's breadth of the ground. The Gambolts quickly slipped off the tail end, protected from any possibility of hostile fire, although there had so far been no overt hostilities, and began working their way through the underbrush, quickly fading out of clear visibility. Fool waited until they were well clear, then signaled for the personnel carrier to move forward again. There was still no clear indication what sort of enemy had attacked the original search party. Evidently, their comm units were still not working correctly. There'd been no further transmissions since the truncated conversation Fool had had with Spartacus. It was quiet, Fool realized. Too quiet. The faintly purring engine of the personnel carrier was the only sound. Even the shouting that Fool had heard previously had now faded into silence, leaving only an uncomfortable anticipation. Somewhere ahead of him, the Gambolts were noiselessly working their way toward the site of the disturbance. Suddenly, a loud sound erupted from the underbrush perhaps 50 meters off the left front of the vehicle. As Fool stood up to stare, realizing even as he did so that he was exposing himself to possible enemy fire, a Gambolt jumped seemingly 2 meters straight up, yowling. It was Dukes, the largest of the three cat-like aliens in Omega Company. As soon as the Gambolt landed on his feet, he let out another yowl and began sprinting for the nearest tree. "What the hell?" said a voice somewhere behind Fool. Dukes reached the tree and, without losing any of his speed, made a right-angle turn and went at least halfway up the trunk before reaching a convenient branch and stopping, with a harassed air about him. The seat of his Black Legion jumpsuit was torn, Fool noticed. At the foot of the tree now, Fool made out a squat creature, quivering with rage. When it spoke, everything became clear. He didn't even need the stereo-oculars to recognize it or to make out what it said. "Woof!" said Barky, the environmental dog, taking off at top speed to find another Gambolt to chase up a tree. "Woof! Woof!"
Chapter 7 Journal Number 681 There are few things more aggravating than a person whose opinions on some important subject are essentially correct, but who insists on subordinating all other matters to that one area of discourse. One might even say that, the more correct the opinion, the more annoying it becomes to see it drive out all other topics of conversation. The only remedy for such people is to avoid their company entirely. Unfortunately, they are often in a position such that avoiding them becomes difficult.
"I've never met such unreasonable people in my life," said Fool, pacing around his desk. The meeting with Chief Inspector Sneef had not been productive.
"That's a rather frightening assessment, sir, especially considering that you've spent the last 5 years in the Space Legion." Beaker left the thought unfinished. Fool ignored him.
"All I ask them to do is to keep their dog away from my people. You wouldn't think that would be so hard, would you?"
"The dog cannot be blamed for its response, sir," Beaker noted. "To put it frankly, sir, even a relatively sophisticated person such as I might find the, characteristic odors of some races of non-human sophons rather peculiar, if not downright unpleasant. You notice that it paid particular attention to poor Spartacus and to the Gambolts. The poor animal, which has a far more sensitive nose than you or I,
simply reacts to them as it has been trained.
It must have been raised in a humans-only environment, said Fool.
But still, my legionnaires aren't polluting the planet. I took special pains to get the most up-to-date ecological protection features built into the base.
We recycle everything, Beaker. Nothing goes to waste in Zenobia Base. Our environmental policies are far greener than the Legion's regulations for units in the field, and we stick to them, too.
I believe you, sir, said Beaker. But I should remind you that I am not the one you need to persuade in this instance. The relevant parties are Miss Sneef and her dog.
I don't know which is worse, said Fool, plopping himself down on the edge of his desk.
At least she didn't try to bite anyone, though maybe that'd be better than having her spout slogans at me all afternoon. If she bit me, all I'd need to do was make sure my shots were up to date.
It is unfortunate that there are no inoculations against fanaticism, said Beaker. The woman's employer is, in my opinion, one of the very few governmental organizations actually capable of making the world better than it finds it, and yet she seems to have the gift, so to speak, of alienating everyone around her. I suppose it is another example of the tendency of bureaucracies to promote those who most excel at bureaucratic infighting, rather than at the actual business of the organization.
Fool had picked up the remote for the office's video display wall and fiddled with it as he listened to Beaker. Now he looked at it, realized he wasn't about to use it for anything, and put it back down on his desk.
The bottom line is, we need to be able to work here, he said. I can't just tell my people not to go near their camp, Beaker. They were out in the desert to investigate a possible threat to our security, and we never did find out what all those lights were about.
Sir, now may be the time to prevail upon Flight Lieutenant Qual to interest his government in the matter, said Beaker. Point out to them that your mission is being jeopardized by this AEIOU team's officious meddling. Perhaps you might even persuade one or two Zenobians to stray out into the desert where they would encounter the dog. That might persuade them quickly.
And if Barky went after them, what would stop them from shooting him, said Fool, or maybe eating him for lunch? The Zenobians don't seem to eat mammals. They don't seem to have very many, in fact, but they might make an exception in this case. Getting an animal killed by the locals, not just any animal, but a beloved environmental dog with his own weekly Tri-V show and fan clubs of adoring kids on every human-occupied planet? No, Beaks. No, thank you. I've already survived more than my share of interplanetary incidents, but I don't think even Ambassador Gottesman could bail me out of that one.
It would have a very unfortunate effect on your public image, I am sure, sir, agreed Beaker. However, I fear that something of the sort is inevitable unless you take steps to prevent it. I am more than ever convinced that General Blitzkrieg has engineered this AEIOU visit in hopes of discrediting you.
Old Blitzkrieg again, eh? Said Fool. Well, by now, he's tried everything short of sending assassins, and the mob has tried that. I'm still here in case you haven't noticed, Beaks. Don't worry, it may take a little while, but I'll figure out some way to get rid of that AEIOU team and their little dog, too.
Beaker shook his head mournfully. Sir, I really wish you had pursued a classical education, he said.
It would help you avoid many infelicitous remarks.
But Fool wasn't listening. Instead, his gaze had gone to the open window facing out onto the parade ground and beyond that, to the open land south of Zenobia Base.
Look, Beaker, he said. There are lights moving out in the desert.
You rabbit ears! Get your motherless ass in here!
Bellowed Sergeant Pitbull, glowering out of his office door. Instinctively, Thumper jumped.
"Yes, Sergeant," he said, scurrying for the office.
The half-dozen other recruits remaining in the barracks room looked at him with a mixture of mild curiosity and relief that they weren't the ones Pitbull had decided to harass during their final hours on Messina's world. Then they went back to their reading, their card games, or whatever they had chosen to pass their remaining time before leaving Legion boot camp forever. Even though Thumper had already gotten his assignment for Omega Company, the sound of the drill sergeant's voice was equivalent to a jolt of high-voltage electricity. Most of the other recruits had already been loaded onto ships, headed for their new assignments. But Omega Company was on some isolated planet, a place without regular traffic. As anxious as Thumper was to join his new outfit, he would have to wait for transport to be arranged. And, as Pitbull had already made clear, nobody was going to go out of his way to get a single bad news rookie to a company full of rejects and troublemakers.
"Recruit Thumper reporting, Sergeant," said Thumper, coming to attention just inside the office door. "Close the door and sit down, Legionnaire," said the sergeant. He spoke in a voice Thumper had never heard him use. For one thing, it would barely have been audible beyond the confines of the office. For another, it didn't carry any of the menacing inflections he was used to hearing from Pitbull. In fact, he'd called him Legionnaire instead of some insulting nickname. And to top it all off, Thumper had never been invited to sit in the sergeant's presence before now. Wondering just what might be wrong, Thumper took the offered seat.
"I wanted to talk to you, so you don't get the wrong idea," said Sergeant Pitbull.
He had a strange expression on his face that Thumper couldn't quite recognize.
"You know, and I know, that somebody set you up to take the big fall when General Blitzkrieg came to inspect the company. And if you think about it, you probably know why it happened."
"Some of the other recruits were mad at me for running the obstacle course too fast," said Thumper, nodding, "and for trying my best at other things when they were happy just getting by."
"That's right," said Pitbull, nodding. "I knew you were smarter than the average sofont. You were showing them up, so they decided they had to make you look so bad you couldn't ever recover from it. Except they forgot one thing, or maybe they never even knew it."
"Forgot something?" Thumper was confused now. "What was it you think they forgot?"
"General Blitzkrieg has a Rippner up his ass about Omega Company," said the sergeant. "He thinks they're total screw-ups. What's more, he thinks their CO, Captain Jester, is the biggest screw-up of all. So when he thinks he's got another troublemaker on his hands, where does he send him?"
"Straight to Omega, Natch."
"Yes, Sergeant, I gathered as much," said Thumper. "I don't know if there's anything I can do to wipe this incident off my record."
"Wipe it off your record?" Pitbull guffawed.
"Why'd you want to do that?"
He leaned forward and lowered his voice even more.
"You want to know the dead cert truth? General Blitzkrieg has been the biggest dork nose in the Legion since before I was a recruit, and that's damn near 30 years now. I damn near hurt myself beyond repair trying to keep from laughing when he got that bucket of slop poured all over him."
"Excuse me?" said Thumper.
"You heard me right," said Pitbull. "The funniest thing is, whoever set you up there was doing you the biggest favor he could have done. I know people in Omega, and from what they tell me, it's the best damn outfit in the Legion for a heads-up guy to be in right now. You play your cards right, and Omega just might be the best thing that ever happened to you."
"Excuse me?" Thumper said again, still not quite convinced that what he was hearing made sense.
"Great coup! You got those big-ass ears, and you still can't hear diddly shit with 'em!"
roared Pitbull. Thumper almost reflexively flinched at the volume. Pitbull smiled and lowered his voice again.
"You know those clowns outside are trying to listen in on us," he said with an actual grin. "You gotta give 'em something to think about."
Yes, Sergeant," said Thumper, still confused. Pitbull leaned forward and said in an even lower voice,
"The thing I wanted to tell you is, you're damn near the best recruit I've had in 10 years. You need to loosen up some, but I figure Omega will do that for you. And you need to pay more attention to getting along with your buddies. No matter how good you are as an individual, it's how you play with a team that's going to make or break you in the Legion. You hear me?"
"Yes, Sergeant," Thumper said again, wondering if he sounded as dull to the sergeant as he did to himself.
"Good," said Pitbull, pushing his chair back from his desk. "The other thing you need to know is that we found you transport to Zenobia, which is where Omega Company is based. There's a bunch of rich civilians taking some kind of damn junket to Zenobia, and somebody convinced them to take on a passenger, which turns out to be you. So, you'll be traveling in style, which ain't so bad after all. Don't let anybody know it. It's supposed to be punishment."
"Yes, Sergeant," said Thumper, considerably more enthusiastically now. "When do I have to be ready to depart?"
"You have to get on the shuttle to Wayne's World 0600 tomorrow morning."
Pitbull stood up, took a deep breath, and suddenly his voice took on its normal bellow.
"You miss it, I'll kick your stinking ass 5 different ways, and then I'll really go to work. Now get the hell out of my sight, rabbit ears."
"Yes, Sergeant," said Thumper one last time, and he scuttled out the door. It was a real job to keep from grinning as he came into view of his fellow recruits, but somehow he managed it.
"If that goddamn dog wasn't an interplanetary mascot for a clean green environment, known and beloved throughout the galaxy, I'd have shot his raggedy ass 4, maybe 5 times right then and there," said Double X.
He was sitting in the desert lounge, Zenobia Base's bar for Legionnaires, with a group of his buddies, sharing a cold beer and the story of his encounters in the wilds outside the camp that day.
Sure. I can just see the story on the Tri-V News. Space Legionnaire kills beloved environmental mascot, said Street, scoffing.
With your picture. Nah, they wouldn't put something that ugly on. They'd put on Barky the environmental dog instead. Even shot full of holes, he'd be a little bit cute.
Cute?
Double X slapped his hand against his forehead.
He gets his choppers in your leg? You tell me about cute then. That's the bitingest dog you ever seen, you or anybody else.
Well, I thought I'd seen everything in the Legion, said Slayer. But when I drove up and saw Spartacus halfway up a tree, I about busted open laughing. If the captain hadn't been there, I bet I would have. I didn't know Cynthians could climb trees.
More like he flew up there on his glide board, said Street.
You're right, though. If I'd seen that, I'd have bust open laughing, too.
I don't think he's funny, said Tuscanini. Barky tried to hurt Legionnaires. Captain must stop Barky.
You Voltrons must not have any pets,
said Supernat, sitting on a bench next to her huge partner. She grinned, then went on.
The thing is, Barky is kinda cute. I mean, kids all over the galaxy have his hollow in their rooms, and they send money to save the trees because of Barky. When I was a kid, I used to think it was really blurgin how he could sniff out pollutants.
When you was a kid, said Duop,
man, that's one long-lived dog.
Ow! He yelled, as Supernat punched him.
Barky's genetically engineered, said Sushi, laughing at his partner. They didn't want to have to replace him every few years, so while they were giving him the genes to let him sniff out methane and fluorocarbons and so on, they made him long-lived, too. If I remember right, he'd be going on 80 years old, even if he'd never started space traveling.
80 or 8, don't give him no right to bite folks,
said Double X, slapping a fist into his open hand.
I was the captain. I'd be telling those A-E-I-O-U suckers to lift their ship before the sun sets on 'em.
I bet he would like to do that,
said Sushi, swirling the ice cubes in his rum and Neo-Coke.
Problem is, the captain can't just order another government agency off the planet except under martial law, which doesn't apply here. If he could get the Zenobians to ask them to leave, that'd be another story. But so far, the Zenobians don't seem interested in them one way or another.
Hey, maybe I can get Barky to chase Lieutenant Qual up a tree, suggested Duop, pointing toward the ceiling to illustrate the idea.
That'd get him interested all right.
You ever get a good look at Qual's teeth? Asked Supernat. He's got about twice as many as any dog you ever saw, and mostly twice as big. Plus, he runs even faster than a Gambolt. If Barky has enough sense to find the meat in a hamburger, and at least his bio says he does, he'll steer clear that fight for all he's worth.
Bio? The fucking dog's got a bio,
said Double X.
Hey, watch your mouth, said Supernat. Barky, the environmental dog, was my favorite icon when I was a kid. I cried for a week when we moved to a new town and my mom forgot to bring along my Barky doll. You talk bad about Barky, I'll whap you.
She flexed her right arm to show him she meant business.
All right,
said Double X, trying to smooth things over. He probably outweighed Supernat by 50 kilos, but everybody in the company knew that what the little Legionnaire started, she finished, with Tuscanini ready to step in if he thought she wasn't getting a fair shake. He rubbed his chin and mused.
I guess all those big media stars got bios, so why not Barky?
Barky's bio says he's the most intelligent dog ever, too, said Supernat, somewhat placated. I read the whole thing when I was a kid, and watched his show every week. It was really triff, watching him chase the pollutus.
Yeah. Except now he seems to think that we're polluters, said Sushi. I don't know how he got that idea. The camp's about as green as you can get. I think we recycle everything we can, certainly anything likely to be useful if we ever had to fight somebody. Of course, the AEIOU probably doesn't take that point into consideration.
War not healthy for ecologies, said Tuscanini. Best reason to prevent war, I thinking.
Maybe that dog do be smarter than he looks, said Street, nodding.
Course, I knowed he was right smart all along when he went biting on Double X.
And that set off another round of good-natured insults and arguments that went on until closing time. The Legionnaires went to bed without figuring out what to do about Barky or how to deal with the AEIOU mission to Zenobia, although they talked enough about those problems to solve them half a dozen times. It probably would not have made them any happier to know that their superior officers were having no better luck. Victor Fool popped a token into the slot of the machine facing him and pulled the lever. There was something gratifying about the activity, just enough mechanical resistance, a sound of gears engaging and wheels spinning, even though he'd been told that the sounds were actually synthesized effects and the gears and wheels were simulations that had nothing to do with the choice of which symbols the machine would display. Instead, an elaborately sealed Heisenberg circuit determined the winning, or more often losing, combination. Whoever had designed the machines had done her job well, Fool grudgingly admitted. It felt as if you could actually use the handle to control which symbols appeared, even when your brain knew the facts to be otherwise. The wheels spun to a halt, and Victor Fool inspected the three symbols in front of him. A bell, a cherry, and a lemon. No payout, this time. Fool picked up his Slado-mat and entered the result. On the whole, he was $47,000 in the red at this point. Considering that the bank of machines he was playing took nothing less than $5,000 tokens, that was a pittance. One decent payout, and he'd be ahead of the game. One significant jackpot, and he'd rake in more for one play than any but the top casino executives made in a year. And if he hit the big one, he chuckled. It was only a matter of time. He was mildly surprised that nobody else seemed interested in these particular machines. Yes, the price of a play was high, but the payouts were proportionately richer than anything else in the Fat Chance Casino. Even 35-1, the odds for playing a single number at the roulette table, was a paltry reward compared to the 1,000,000-1 jackpot the casino had posted for these machines. Well, if no one else played, no one else had the chance to win, did they? Determinedly, Victor Fool fished in his pocket and took out another token. He was about to feed it into the machine when someone close behind him said,
"Having any luck today?"
He turned to see a woman's face, youngish, dark-haired, and rather pretty, though not on the vidstar level. Almost inevitably, she knew who he was and how much money he had. Victor Fool was not without ego, but he had no reason to believe he was the type of man who would appeal to many women if his wealth were suddenly to disappear. On the other hand, he had an excellent notion of just how attractive that wealth was to almost everyone else he met. After all, the galaxy has room for only a limited number of multi-billionaires, which meant that the vast majority of those around him at any given time had far less money than he, and had at least some interest in altering what they perceived as an unnatural imbalance. From Victor Fool's point of view, of course, that imbalance was very much the natural state of affairs, and he saw no reason to give anyone a chance to change it to his disadvantage. So his first response to the question was to verify, out of the corner of his eye, that his bodyguard was nearby, paying due attention to the situation. Sure enough, Eddie Grossman was only a step or two away, pretending to play the slots while looking in his direction. The guard lifted a forefinger to his left ear, signaling that he had already scanned the woman for weapons and found nothing to set off his alarms. Good. That eliminated one source of worry, although there were, of course, plenty of ways to damage or kill someone without carrying a detectable weapon. That verified, Victor Fool decided to indulge himself with a few moments' conversation.
"Luck doesn't enter into it," he said. "Beating these machines is easy, if you have a good system and stick to it."
"You must have a lot of faith in your system," said the woman, eyeing the machine that Fool had just been playing. "Could you teach me how to play?"
Victor Fool looked at her again, sizing her up.
"You don't look as if you have enough money to play on these machines," he said. "They're $5,000 minimum."
"Yes, that's what convinced me you must have a good system," said the woman.
She paused, then said,
"My name is Lola, by the way."
Fool ignored her attempt to get his name.
"You need to get a set of 5 machines and protect them from anyone else playing them until you've won your quota. So, if you were thinking about putting a token in one of these, forget about it."
Lola smiled.
"I'm afraid that even if I had your confidence, I don't have your bankroll. If I like your system enough to try it, it'll be on the $5 machines. But go ahead, Mr.—"
"Next thing is, you have to set yourself an amount you're going to win, and once you win it, you stop for the day. Slot machines are calibrated to take a certain percentage of the bets made on them, so you have to resist the belief that you can hit the jackpot twice in a row."
"I see," said Lola. "So you're feeding your own bank of machines until they pay off, then quitting while you're ahead?"
"Yes, essentially that's it," said Victor Fool. "I'm betting that most of the players are too undisciplined to follow a system like mine. So their losses build the jackpot even bigger for me, you see?"
"I guess so,"
said Lola, nodding dubiously.
"But what happens if—"
By then, Victor Fool had decided that the young woman was interesting, but not enough so to distract him from his mission of breaking the bank at the Fat Chance Casino. He rubbed his palms together, a signal to the bodyguard, and said, "Well, miss, it's been a pleasure talking to you, but I really have to get back to work here."
And no sooner were the words out of his mouth than Eddie Grossman was there, gently taking the woman by the elbow and steering her toward the exit, talking quietly to her. Eddie was good at what he did. Most likely the young woman would never be aware that she'd been given the brush off. If he wanted to renew the conversation, it would be as if nothing had ever broken it off. He put a token in the slot and pulled the lever. Lola walked out of the high rollers lounge in the Fat Chance Casino, burning with curiosity. Her first encounter with Victor Fool had been much stranger than she had expected. About the only thing that fit any predictable pattern was the bodyguards moving in gently to encourage her to end the conversation with his client. Fool must have flashed him some signal she'd missed, but that was all right. She'd actually gotten to talk to him much longer than she'd hoped to. Unfortunately, she hadn't learned very much of use. Victor Fool's explanations of why he was playing the casino's quantum slots didn't make any sense, and that set off her alarms. She didn't see any reason to point out that nobody else but the armaments tycoon was playing the $5,000 machines. Without the undisciplined players he depended on to build up the losses, his supposed system was nonsense. Besides, everybody but the most unthinking fish knew that the slots gave the worst odds in the whole casino. Obviously, nobody who could build a financial empire like Foolproof Industries could be so cavalier about throwing away his money, so there must be something else going on. What was Victor Fool's real game? Was his conspicuous high-rolling nothing more than shilling, meant to encourage others to play recklessly? Was his so-called system just a way to convince players that the slots might not be the bad investment that every sensible gambler claimed they were? Or was something even deeper going on here? Lola did her best to keep her face cheerful, to keep Victor Fool talking. Whatever his game was, she intended to find out, and to be there to scam him out of a share of the proceeds, whatever it did pay off. It wasn't going to be an easy job, Lola told herself, but it had a lot better chance of paying off than Victor Fool's system for playing the slots, and whether or not he realized it, she had a lot more at stake than he did. She smiled again. Always bet on the hungry fighter, said the old gambler's cliché. One thing for sure, she was a lot hungrier than Victor Fool, and she was going to get her bite out of him, one way or another. Back at Zenobia Base, Willard Fool's wrist intercom buzzed. Then Mother's voice came through the speaker.
"Hate to wake you up, cutie pie, but we've detected an incoming ship. You might want to tidy up before they get here."
Fool, who had been wide awake, it was mid-afternoon after all, and working at his desk, grinned.
"Thanks, Mother," he said. "That must be the party of bigwigs we've got to entertain for Ambassador Gottesman. Try to hail them and patch me in whenever they answer."
"Will do, sweetums,"
purred Mother, and she broke the connection.
"Do you plan to meet these, bigwigs in person?" asked Beaker, looking up from the financial program he'd been running.
"Sure, if it really is them," said Fool.
"I'm not going to go charging out to meet just anybody again. I learned my lesson with those AEIOU inspectors. I all but rolled out the red carpet for them, and they've been nothing but trouble ever since."
"That's an understatement, sir," said Beaker, sniffing faintly. "I found them an unpleasant company from the beginning. I am more and more convinced that they were dispatched here by one of your enemies and now need to find sufficient violations to justify the expense of shipping them to this planet."
"It does seem like the kind of thing General Blitzkrieg would try," Fool said, musing, "although it might even be a bit too subtle for him. He's more the kind to try something direct, like sending Major Botch up to replace me in command. That's the old Legion way, which is all Blitzkrieg seems to understand."
"I don't think I'd use the term understand to describe the General's mental processes," said Beaker. "Still, I wouldn't be so quick to overlook the possibility that he might from time to time come into the possession of competent advice and actually follow it, even as you do on occasion, sir."
Fool stared at Beaker, trying to figure out whether or not the butler expected him to take offense at the comment. After a long moment, he shrugged and said,
"Well, I can't deny the possibility. But now that they're here, figuring out who sicked them on us is secondary to figuring out how to get them off a company's back. I think we're about as environment-friendly—"
"A barbarous locution," muttered Beaker.
Fool hesitated one beat, then continued.
"About as environmental-friendly as we can be, and still carry out our mission," he said.
He was by now used to the butler's correcting his grammar and diction on the fly, although he couldn't always figure out exactly what Beaker was objecting to. Judging from Beaker's sour expression, his attempt to correct himself hadn't made things any better.
"Besides, this is the Zenobians' homeworld," he added. "I'd think as long as they're happy with the company's performance,
a bunch of Alliance bureaucrats don't have much to say about it.
Don't be so sure of that, sir, said Beaker. Have you looked into the precise terms on which Zenobia joined the Alliance? I would be very surprised if the natives of a new world were allowed to come in without major concessions to the powers that be, of which the regulatory bureaucracy is a not insignificant constituent. Having gotten a toehold on this world, the AEIOU is bound to do all it can to increase its power and influence here. No sensible person could expect otherwise.
Fool frowned. I think I'm going to send Chief Potentary Korg a note about these people, emphasizing that they came without our being informed. From the way he acted when I told him about the hunting party, he's pretty touchy about what off-worlders try to do on Zenobia.
Fool was interrupted by the buzz of his communicator.
Captain, we've made contact with the incoming ship, said Mother. Just as you thought. It's those fat cats Ambassador Gottesman sent here. You want to talk to them, or shall I send them away?
Oh, thanks, Mother, said Fool. Of course I'll talk to them. Put them through. Then a new thought crossed his mind. Actually, give me a moment to think about where to have them land. I'd rather not have the AEIOU people notice them.
It'll be rather a challenge to keep someone from noticing a nearby shuttle landing, sir, said Beaker. At least, I can think of nothing short of having them alight on the opposite side of the planet, which hardly seems compatible with the Ambassador's orders to treat them as honored guests.
You're right, muttered Fool. Wait a moment. Why don't we invite the AEIOU people to tour our base, show them all the latest environment-friendly features built into it?
It's still a barbarous locution, said Beaker.
And while they're indoors, the bigwig shuttle can land without the AEIOU team noticing it, Fool continued. He was grinning now. We just have to keep the two groups from noticing one another. Mother, you call the AEIOU team and extend the invitation. Nicely, mind you. I'll talk to the hunters and stall them while we get the environmentalists out of the way. If we play our cards right, we can keep them from ever knowing of each other's presence. And maybe we can even persuade the AEIOU that we're really nice guys after all.
It's a really stupid idea, but it just might work, said Mother. I'll do my best, sweetie, but if they bring Barky, all bets are off.
I doubt we can get them to leave Barky behind, said Fool. Well, just warn everybody, particularly the non-humans in the company, that he's coming, and that they might want to watch their step.
In case Barky decides to drop a little pollution of his own? Asked Mother.
Before Fool could answer, she said,
I'll pass the word, Sweetie Pooh. Hold on now, I'm patching the hunters through.
There was a light crackling sound from Fool's wrist communicator, and a red LED glowed. Hello, said Fool. This is Captain Jester of Omega Company. Welcome to Zenobia. I've got my people preparing a landing area for you, so I'm going to ask you to take one more orbit of the planet.
Beaker rolled his eyes. He knew, as surely as he knew Zenobia's sun would rise the next morning, that there was going to be more trouble, and he knew perfectly well whose job it was going to get Fool out of it. He sighed. He'd taken the job with open eyes, and there was no point getting annoyed about it now. Still, the boy ought to have learned something by now.
Chapter 8 Journal Number 688
My employer, for all his dedication to the military life, was at bottom a businessman. In that, he resembled his father. He also resembled that gentleman in a firm conviction that his own view of the world was fundamentally accurate, and that others who did not share it were in need of correction. Unlike his father, he was at least willing to give those others sufficient data to arrive at such a correction. It did not occur to him that others might interpret the same data differently. It must have been some such motivation that induced him to invite the AEIOU inspection team to tour the Legion base camp. The fact that, to all appearances, they had come to the planet with the express purpose of shutting down that very camp seemed to carry no weight with him. Surely he can't have been so foolish as to believe that an afternoon's VIP tour would be enough to overcome the chief inspector's evident belief that a military unit was, by its very definition, incapable of adhering to environmentally correct policies.
"Welcome to Zenobia Base," said Lieutenant Rembrandt,
smiling as she met Chief Inspector Sneef and her AEIOU team in the courtyard. Fool had chosen her and Sushi, who had the closest approximation of all his legionnaires to something resembling diplomatic temperament, to make up the greeting party. The three AEIOU inspectors, accompanied by Barky, the environmental dog, had walked from their camp to the Legion base. Fool had, of course, offered to send a hover jeep for them, but Sneef had turned him down peremptorily.
"Non-essential energy use is a crime against posterity," she snarled. "The Legion should have a greater sense of its role in preserving precious resources."
Now Chief Inspector Sneef looked suspiciously at Omega Company's modular base camp unit.
"I see a great many artificial materials being used here," she said. "That must have had a high energy cost."
She and her two assistants were wearing uniforms of some coarsely woven natural fiber.
"We don't have much choice in a semi-arid setting," said Rembrandt. "The Zenobians insisted that we site our base camp here so as not to use up territory they considered more valuable. As you may know..."
"The Zenobians should consider all their territory untouchable," said Inspector Slurry. "If the locals can't recognize its value, it's our mission to show them. We have already had ample occasion to marvel at the wildlife in this area."
"That's funny," said Sushi with a broad smile. "I've had quite a few encounters with the wildlife out there. As best as I can recall, I was usually too busy trying to keep the little beasties from biting or stinging me to have much time left to marvel at them. Do you have some kind of secret vermin repellent, or do the local critters just respect your proper green attitude?"
"Sushi,"
said Rembrandt. Fool had instructed them to avoid antagonizing the visitors.
"That's all right, Lieutenant," said Inspector Gardner with a grin,
apparently the only one the AEIOU team had brought with it. He turned to Sushi and said,
"We get our share of bites, too. The main trick to avoiding them is to learn when the various animals are actively feeding and stay out of their territory then. If we absolutely have to work in a certain area when the local bug equivalents are active, we wear protective clothing."
Sneef nodded.
"After all, our blood could be poisonous to them, which means their bites would do them a lot more harm than us. This is their world, after all. We would be remiss if we exposed them to danger."
"I don't know," said Sushi. "I bet the other animals on the planet don't think twice about squishing a bug that's trying to bite them. Why, when we were traveling through the desert with Flight Lieutenant Qual..."
"Why don't we take our visitors to meet the captain?"
said Rembrandt, cutting Sushi off in mid-sentence. She'd already heard how Qual had used his stunner to clear annoying vermin from the Legionnaire's path during their desert mission a few months before, and she didn't expect the AEIOU team would find the story enlightening. She was also under strict orders to get the inspectors inside the base before the hunting party's shuttle began its landing approach.
"I think you'll be surprised at some of the environmentally friendly features built into the module," she said, pointing toward the closest entrance. "If you'll follow me inside."
"Woof,"
said Barky. The environmental dog had been sitting politely nearby, generally ignoring the activity in the camp around him. Quickly, Rembrandt turned, hoping there wasn't going to be trouble. Fool had warned everyone in Omega Company that the dog was coming to visit. That gave the non-human legionnaires, or anyone else to whom Barky seemed to have taken a particular dislike, the chance to make themselves scarce. That didn't mean that Barky might not take a particular dislike to yet another member of the Omega mob. There stood Mahatma, smiling his beatific smile at the environmental dog.
"Hello," said the little legionnaire. "It is not often that a famous animal star visits Omega Company."
Rembrandt took a deep breath. So far, at least, Barky didn't seem to be taking exception to Mahatma's presence. But she knew Mahatma too well, especially his uncanny ability to find the single most unsettling question to ask in any given situation. That might not make Barky angry, but she couldn't be sure that Chief Inspector Sneef wouldn't sick the dog on him if she thought he was getting impertinent, and Mahatma could get very impertinent.
"Mahatma," said Lieutenant Rembrandt, "weren't you supposed to be on perimeter guard duty just now?"
Maybe he'd get the hint. But Mahatma wasn't taking any hints.
"I wonder why the inspectors risk bringing a genetically engineered animal into this world."
Rembrandt stepped forward, putting an arm around Mahatma's shoulders.
I'm sure the inspectors know exactly what they're doing." "Oh, we can speak for ourselves, Lieutenant,"
said Chief Inspector Sneef with a predatory smile.
"Of course Barky is genetically engineered," she continued, "but since there are no other creatures of his species here, there is no chance of his passing on his genes, and therefore no threat to the Zenobian environment."
"On worlds with other dogs, we take additional precautions, naturally,"
added Inspector Slurry.
"Naturally,"
said Mahatma, still smiling broadly.
"Well, shall we go see the captain?"
said Rembrandt, attempting to herd the environmental inspectors toward the entrance to the base module. It was only a matter of moments before Mahatma sprung his inevitable follow-up question, which was likely to be even more unsettling than the first one. She wasn't fast enough.
"Of course, there are other ways for those genes to get into the environment," said Mahatma.
Slurry looked at him quizzically.
"I'm not sure what you mean."
Mahatma's smile got even wider.
"There are many hungry beasts on this planet," he said. "What if one of them ate the poor environmental dog?"
"Ate Barky?"
said Sneef, her jaw falling.
Be very, very careful, urged Mahatma. I am sure the AEIOU would not want to be responsible for destroying an unspoiled ecology because it let its famous mascot roam about unguarded.
He smiled and bowed and turned away, leaving the three inspectors dumbfounded. Rembrandt said once more,
Shall we go see the inside of the base? Yes, by all means, said Sneef, looking around apprehensively. Come, Barky, stay close to me.
Woof,
said Barky, the environmental dog, lifting a hind leg to give his ear a vigorous scratch.
A slot system?
Ernie sat up, an eager expression on his face.
You know, if he's really got one, it's like money in the bank. People have been looking for a way to cut the house odds and slots for centuries.
Ernie, we're talking about Victor Fool, the arms dealer, said Lola. This is a man who already has more money in the bank than most small planetary governments. He's the last person in the galaxy to need a system for beating slots.
Hey, maybe he's like, diversifying, said Ernie.
He took a sip of his cold beer and added,
You know, in case the old arms business goes through some hard times. I hear wars are a bit scarce nowadays.
Right, and the food business might hit a patch of real hard times, too, said Lola, scornfully. Whatever reason Victor Fool has for playing those slots, it's not because he needs the money or the exercise, either. If we can figure out his game, there's a good chance we can get in on it.
What if he's just having fun? Asked Ernie. You know, even a rich guy must like to let his head down and stop pinching every last penny. Some guys tool around in space yachts. Some play to rocket races. Maybe the old boy gets his splats out by throwing 5 skrgunchies into a slot and pulling the handle. Hey, he can afford it.
It's such a dumb idea. It might even be right, admitted Lola.
She paced back and forth in her stocking feet, thinking out loud.
But we can't ignore the chance that he's up to something bigger, Ernie. Besides, he's the closest person on the station to the guy we're supposed to be snatching. He could be the whole key to our getting off of Lorelei's station with our hides intact, not to mention coming out ahead of the game. It's worth our time and effort to scope out whatever it is he's doing and look for a way to turn it to our own advantage.
I'll buy into that, I guess, said Ernie.
He spread his hands apart, palms up, and said,
Thing is, how are you going to find out what he's doing? You already asked him flat out, and you don't want to believe the answer he gave you. So, what have you got that's better?
I don't know, yet.
Lola peered out the window of their modestly priced room. The view was nothing special, another block of workers' living quarters like theirs. Then again, nobody came to Lorelei expecting to see natural beauty, unless the showgirls in the casino fit that description. Some did. Lola drummed her fingers on the plastic glass, then turned to Ernie and said,
Victor Fool is the real thing. Even a small fraction of his money could put us on Easy Street. But we can't afford any mistakes. The one thing I don't want to do is alert him, or more likely his bodyguards, that somebody's keeping an eye on him. So, I need you to do some of the spy work. You think you're up to it?
Sure, sure, said Ernie, stretching. You know me.
That's why I'm worried, said Lola.
She walked over and put her hand on Ernie's head.
This bodyguard isn't some third-rate musclehead, said Lola. I don't know where he came from, but he's very smooth and very professional. He's likely to remember my face a good long time, so I've got to be really careful where and when I pop up.
I get the picture, babes, said Ernie. What you want me to do is peek over the old boy's shoulder, try to figure out his system, but keep the guard from noticing. Nothing to it.
Wrong,
said Lola. And she smacked her hand on the top of his head.
You couldn't fool this guard if he spotted you 6 dry martinis and a fake beard. I'm sorry, Ernie. He's just way out of your class, and nearly out of mine, I think. But I've got a plan.
Yeah, sure, said Ernie, rubbing his head where she'd hit him. Your last brilliant plan blew up in our face, with nothing to show for it until we got sent back here to finish the job right, at our own expense. What kind of dope do you think I am?
A smarter one because of what's already happened, said Lola. And so am I. Listen to this.
Ernie listened, skeptically at first, pointing out objections to Lola's plan, but gradually he began to nod, then enthusiastically to offer suggestions of his own. Finally, after nearly an hour, he said,
All right, you win. It's worth a try, especially considering we got nothing else to try.
Good, said Lola. Now, here's what I want you to do first.
The shuttle was already on the ground and the dust of its landing mostly settled when Gears guided the Legion hover jeep over a low hill and came into sight of it. There were a couple of men at work unloading large cases of equipment from an open hatchway,
and another stood studying a map under the shade of the shuttle. The afternoon sun was beating down fiercely, without a trace of cloud in the sky. Lieutenant Armstrong stood up in the passenger seat and waved.
"Hello, the shuttle," he called.
Fool had chosen him to greet the hunting expedition, while he and Lieutenant Rembrandt escorted the AEIOU inspectors on a tour of the Legion base. The landing party turned and stared as Gears brought the hover jeep down a short distance away from where they stood. As it touched down, Armstrong leapt out and strode over to the newcomers.
"I'm Lieutenant Armstrong, Omega Company," he said, extending a hand. "Welcome to Zenobia."
One of the hunters, a stocky man with short gray hair and a vaguely military style, stepped forward and took Armstrong's hand in a crusher grip.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Lieutenant," he said. His voice was an incongruous combination of rasp and drawl. "I'm L.P. Osho. We hear tell there's some mighty good hunting hereabouts. Looking forward to seeing what kind of wild and woolly critters you have for us to shoot."
"Wild is no problem, Mr. Osho," said Armstrong, "but I don't think you'll find very much in the way of woolly on Zenobia. The animals here tend to have mostly scales."
"Ha ha! Fella's got a good sense of humor," said Osho. "Here, let me introduce you to the other fellers. This is Austin Tayshun. He's a big-ass lawyer, but he ain't all that bad you get to know him. And over there's good old Houston Obetter. You probably heard of him, on account he's the richest son of a gun on T-Jazz."
"Pleased to meet you all," said Armstrong, shaking the men's hands as they were offered to him.
Osho's description notwithstanding, Tayshun was a small, wiry man with penetrating eyes. He gave Armstrong a steady look and said,
"Interesting country here. You don't suppose there's any chance we could hire one of the natives for a guide, do you?"
"I suppose it's possible," said Armstrong.
"To tell the truth, we haven't really had contact with any of them other than the military. I think they've put us out here in part to isolate us from their civilian population."
He tried to remember if he'd even set eyes on a Zenobian other than those in Flight Lieutenant Qual's unit. To the best of his knowledge, he hadn't. Was that also intentional on the Zenobian's part? He wasn't sure.
"Not very friendly of them, I'd say," drawled Osho. "Well, if we can't get a native, we'll just do the best we can without. How soon can we light out for the killing grounds?"
"Fairly soon, I think," said Armstrong. "Captain Jester wants to schedule a briefing as soon as is convenient with you, and then we can get you to the designated hunting areas."
"Briefing?"
Ostentation interrupted.
"What, does your captain think private citizens are subject to military discipline?"
Armstrong cleared his throat.
"Mr. Tayshun, Zenobia is an inhabited planet with its own laws and government. The Zenobian government retains the right to decide which off-world visitors may visit their world and under what conditions. By inviting the Space Legion to operate here, they have effectively given us the right to bring in what personnel we consider necessary to the mission. Now, at the request of your friends in the State Department, Captain Jester has persuaded the Zenobians to permit you to hunt the local animals in designated areas, provided you follow certain rules. I think you'll agree that knowing what the rules are will make it a lot easier to follow them. So, this briefing is simply an opportunity for the captain to tell you what's expected of you and to answer any questions you may have about Zenobia."
"Long-winded cuss, ain't he?"
said Houston Obetter, a tall, shambling fellow with a grin that suggested unplumbed depths of ignorance. He emphasized his point with an elbow in Tayshun's ribs.
"But what the hell? Let's go meet this captain so we can get it over with. The sooner I can start shooting a few critters, the better, says I. I ain't even seen no dinos yet."
"Dinos might not be the right term," said Armstrong, glad of a chance to change the subject.
"The local sofants do resemble certain species of dinosaurs, but the other fauna we've seen are pretty varied. Why—" He broke off suddenly as a strange being came into his view.
"What in goo's name is that?"
The creature that had emerged from the hunter's shuttle was furry, long-eared, round-faced, and about two-thirds Armstrong's height. It was evidently some kind of sofant, because it was wearing a large backpack and a loose black garment that had a remarkable resemblance to a Space Legion uniform. Armstrong watched open-mouthed as it approached him. It stopped a short distance away, came to attention, and saluted. Rather smartly, Lieutenant Armstrong thought. As he stared open-mouthed, the new sofant said,
"Legionnaire Recruit Thumper reporting for duty to Omega Company, sir."
"Legionnaire?"
"Thumper?"
said Armstrong.
"Oh, yeah, we forgot to tell you," said L.P. Osho. "The government asked us to give this bunny a ride here, since there was no other ships coming this way. He wasn't really much trouble, and I guess he's yours now."
I'll be doggoned, said Gears, who'd stood back and watched the conversation between Armstrong and the hunters without comment.
Every time you think you know what to expect in Omega Company, it just gets weirder. Throw your pack in a jeep, buddy. I guess you'll be riding back to camp with us.
Yes, sir, said Thumper, who still had the recruit's automatic and generally accurate assumption that everybody and everything wearing a Legion uniform outranked him.
Save the sir stuff for the officers, said Gears. I'm Gears, and since the lieutenant still seems to be gaping for air, I guess I'm the one who's got to welcome you to Zenobia and to the Omega Mob. I don't know what kind of outfit you come here from, but I can guarantee you it's a whole lot different here.
The monitor of Sushi's computer displayed a rapidly changing series of not quite random characters, and the speaker emitted a tantalizing series of hisses and grunts, which the auto-translator stubbornly declined to render into anything that the three men in the room could make sense of. Sushi and Lieutenant Rembrandt had delivered the AEIOU inspectors to the captain, at which point Sushi had remembered that Reb was coming by today for a progress report. Fortunately, the officers were willing to dispense with his services for the rest of the afternoon. Unfortunately, what Sushi had to report to Reb was not exactly progress.
"Looks like nothing but garbage to me," said Duop.
"Hey, Sush, you sure that ain't just somebody's unshielded belt sander, or maybe a can opener?"
"Well, it's the wrong frequency for that," said Sushi. "I know this is some written document off the Zenobian's web, or whatever they call it, but until we can get the translator to recognize the input as some kind of articulate language, it might as well be garbage."
"Well, we know the translator works on spoken Zenobian," said Rev. "We can all understand Flight Lieutenant Qual, or at least most of the time, so the written language shouldn't be all that much harder."
He paused and looked at Sushi.
"Should it?"
"I'd need to know a lot more about written Zenobian to tell you, Rev," said Sushi. "I suppose one of us ought to ask Qual just how their writing system works. If it's straight phonetic, the translator ought to be able to make sense of it sooner or later. If it's not, well, if it's not, then we could be way over our heads, guys."
"I'm over my head just listening to this stuff," said Duop.
"Do you know what he means, Rev?"
"Mostly," said Rev. "What kinds of things are you worried about, son?" "We don't know how many languages the Zenobians speak, or who speaks what," said Sushi, counting on his fingers. "Maybe the ruling classes speak a different language from the ordinary people. Maybe their older books are in the same language as their modern ones, maybe not. I mean, there were some religions on old Earth that used a whole different language for their sacred texts than the people spoke in everyday life."
"Maybe." "That's way too many maybes," said Duop, a concerned look on his face.
"You know, you keep running your mind so hard, you're going to get a really rotten headache. What I do is whenever my brain starts running around in circles, I go get myself a couple of three cold brews and stop thinking for a while. You want to do that, Sush? You don't watch it, you'll be just like an officer."
"Yeah, yeah," said Sushi. "And if I don't do this job, I'll have to go back to work on something a lot less interesting. The problem we have right now is to find out how the Zenobian's written language works, which means doing some field work with the only Zenobians we have handy. Who's gonna talk to Qual?"
"He's bound to get suspicious if I ask him anything about their writing," said Rev. "And when that happens, he starts messing with my head. At least, I think that's what he's doing. Anyways, his answers don't hardly make sense. One of you boys is gonna have to go ask him for me."
"Well, I'm out," said Duop. "I can't understand half of what you guys are talking about, let alone Qual. I think his translator's buggy, the way it screws up words."
"Buggy translator," mused Sushi. "You know, that gives me an idea. I think I know just the trick to get Qual started talking about spoken and written Zenobian without him suspecting what Rev's up to."
"And that's what, son?" asked Rev.
Sushi grinned. "I'll tell you after I've found out whether it works, which I'm going to find out right now. See you later."
And out the door he went, leaving Rev and Duop staring at each other. After a moment, Duop shrugged.
"Guess this is as good a time as we're going to get for some cold ones. Gotta stop them headaches before they start. Catch you later, Rev."
And he went out the door as well, leaving Rev alone. Rev turned and looked at the shifting characters on Sushi's computer monitor, squinting as if it might help him discern a pattern in the rapid flow. After a while, he shook his head and blinked. Everything was tantalizingly close to making sense, and yet none of it did. He put his hands in the pockets of his not-quite-Legion-issue jumpsuit, turned to the door, and sauntered out. For now, he would leave it up to Sushi. If Sushi couldn't solve the problem, he'd decide what to do then.
Until that point, Duop's advice actually sounded good. He stopped and looked in the mirror, taking a moment to touch up his hairdo. The king had always made it a point to keep up his appearance. Finally satisfied, he turned and headed down the corridor toward the officers' club, whistling softly to himself. Thumper's departure for the Legion base was delayed, while Lieutenant Armstrong persuaded the hunters to stay and set up their camp instead of coming immediately to see the captain.
"We'll take you there this evening," Armstrong told the hunters, smiling. "Captain Jester just sent me to make sure you had everything you needed, and it looks as if you do. Since that's straightened out, I'll head back to the camp, and you'll be seeing the captain as soon as he's free."
"I can't imagine what your captain's got to do on this here planet that's so important he can't talk to some of his constituents," said Ostentation, who seemed to be the leader of the hunting party.
"We've contributed..." "Excuse me, sir," said the lieutenant, whose smile had abruptly vanished. "The captain isn't an elected official, so of course he doesn't have any constituents, and I don't recall hearing that the Legion ran on political contributions."
"Well, sonny, we've contributed a whole shitload to the folks that give the Legion its orders," said Tation. "I reckon they'd be right concerned to find out that the Legion don't pay no never mind to their constituents' needs. Why, I'm surprised the captain didn't come out himself instead of sending his messenger boy."
"Mr. Tation, I will attribute your remarks to ignorance and overlook them on that account," said Armstrong frostily. "I have given you my word as an officer that Captain Jester will receive you as soon as he has completed certain urgent business, and I should think that would suffice. Now, Mr. Tation, if there's nothing else..."
The hunters took the hint at last, and the hover jeep headed back to the Legion base, with Thumper riding on the back seat. Thumper wasn't sure just what to expect from Omega Company, probably because he'd spent much of his time in basic training under the illusion that the Legion actually worked the way the recruiting brochures had told him. His fund of Legion rumor and gossip was possibly even smaller than that of the average recruit. Belatedly, he'd realized he needed to catch up. But by then, he was leaving Legion boot camp, a passenger in a civilian ship that just happened to be headed his way. Somebody had called in a favor, and Thumper was the beneficiary, or so he hoped. The civilians on board were all humans, like most of those he'd met since leaving his home world. None of them seemed to know very much about Omega Company or its commanding officer. And in any case, they had very little to say to Thumper. They were much more interested in telling improbable stories about their hunting exploits. This struck Thumper as an incredible waste of time, since none of them seemed to believe any of the other stories, or even listen to them very much. And since he showed almost no interest in the subject that dominated their conversation, they quickly stopped trying to impress him. That was all right with Thumper. He needed time to reassess the lessons of basic training, which evidently went well beyond such superficial matters as marching, saluting, and running the obstacle course. All that he'd managed as well as anyone in his squad. In fact, according to Sergeant Pitbull, he'd completed the obstacle course in record time. But by showing how fast he could run the course, he'd made enemies, which made no sense to him, even after his buddy sat him down and tried to explain it to him. One thing he did understand: making enemies had gotten him in trouble with General Blitzkrieg, which in turn had gotten him sent to Omega Company. That at least made sense once he learned of the General's long-standing grudge against Captain Jester and Omega Company. That story was apparently known throughout the Legion, although Thumper hadn't heard as much as a peep about it until his assignment to Omega came through. Only then had the other recruits taken him aside and told him what they'd heard, and Thumper's ears had stood on end, and his eyes grew wider and wider. The only problem was, the stories contradicted each other on almost every point. Some said that Omega was a dumping ground for the dregs of the Legion, and its CO a certified madman who turned every Legion rule on its head. Others said it was the softest duty a Legionnaire could get, with routine assignments to fancy resort worlds and officers who let all discipline go by the boards. And others said it was the one unit in the Legion where a Legionnaire wasn't strapped in with archaic rules and mindlessly enforced regulations, where Sofont, with some imagination and ambition, might find a niche for himself. Thumper had taken advantage of his copious spare time on the voyage to research Omega Company and Captain Jester on the web, and what he found there was every bit as contradictory as the rumors he'd heard. A long string of news reports from Jenny Higgins made Captain Jester look like the kind of hero Thumper had always thought of as the essence of the Legion, the active, resourceful leader of an intrepid band. But other reports portrayed the captain as a laughingstock, and his company, to quote the governor of one planet where they'd been stationed, as the idiot bastard offspring of a travesty and a calamity. Thumper had to look up a couple of those words in the human dictionary. He still wasn't sure what to make of it when he found out what they meant, or whether he liked what it meant for him.
But like it or not, here he was, riding the last couple of kilometers to his destination on the back seat of a Legion hover jeep. Gears chattered the whole way back to the camp, pointing out various features of the desert and asking Thumper how he'd come to be assigned to the company.